Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent affiliated stations, the 20th anniversary University of Chicago Roundtable. To open today's program, we present Alan Simpson, chairman of the Faculty Board of Radio of the University of Chicago.
On Sunday morning, February the 1st, 1931, three professors of the University of Chicago gathered around an old-fashioned carbon microphone to discuss the Wickersham Report on Prohibition. From that moment, there began the first regularly scheduled educational program in the history of radio. It was christened the Round Table, after a certain well-known table in the dining room of the faculty club. Today is the 20th anniversary of that Sunday morning. In establishing the Round Table, the University of Chicago seized upon a new means of fortifying an old ideal. The undertaking was ambitious, but the principles involved were clear. First, radio was a unique and massive instrument for molding the American mind. Second, it was the duty of a university to use this instrument as a means of universal education. Third, its platform should provide a hearing for the best available talent inside and outside the national community. It should seek to unite all the resources of leadership in a joint examination of our problems, our hopes, and our failures. Fourth, this platform should try to provide a model for every form of purposeful discussion in which free and responsible men engage. Lastly, acting in the image of the educational ideal, no principles of exclusion should be admitted except the principle which denies a hearing to passion, dishonesty, and incompetence. There would be no axe to grind, no censorship, open or concealed. These principles have never been sacrificed to widen the hearing or to solicit any interest narrower than the best interest of the American people. Yet the hearing has widened year after year, and the Round Table has won both the confidence of a national network and the loyalty of the stations which it serves. It is today the most widely heard program of its kind. The role of America's universities in radio and of radio in American life has been defined by Robert M. Hutchins as follows: to formulate, to clarify, to vitalize the ideals which should animate mankind is the heavy burden which rests upon the universities. The task of the Round Table is candid and intrepid thinking about fundamental issues. Free discussion is a necessary condition of a free society. Where men cannot freely convey their thoughts to one another, no freedom is secure. Where freedom of expression exists, the beginnings of a free society and a means for every extension of liberty are already present. On this anniversary date, the Round Table will discuss one of the most vital issues confronting Americans today, the issue of national security and individual freedom. To introduce our program, we first present, by transcription, the Honorable Adlai Stevenson, Governor of Illinois.
The topic of today's roundtable, national security and individual freedom, seems to me most appropriate because this is the 20th birthday of the roundtable. The University of Chicago has maintained this tradition of free discussion for 20 years of continuous broadcasting. And I wish I could have participated personally in this roundtable discussion because the appointment this past week by President Truman of the Commission on Internal Security and Individual Rights, headed by Admiral Nimitz, reminds us again that we have failed miserably to find a way to protect ourselves against treason, sabotage, and other subversive acts on the one hand, without destroying our traditional liberties on the other. The enormously important problem the President has assigned this commission is, in short, to seek the widest balance that can be struck between security and freedom. It is high time, indeed I think it is past time, for a reasoned, impartial, objective study of the closely related subjects of national security and individual freedom. There have been too many wild, irresponsible accusations of disloyalty. The dreadful concept of guilt by association has been added to our language. The slanderer is honored. The shadow of suspicion and fear slopes across our land. There is even talk of thought control among Thomas Jefferson's people. Fear for the integrity of one's good name and the security of one's job has spread like a pall through government, stifling initiative and depriving us of valuable manpower. On the other hand, this is a national emergency. The world, the free world, that we have known is in danger. Believing as we do in a community of free nations and of free peoples acting peacefully and responsibly through governments freely chosen, we conclude at last that we cannot live in comfortable security with a great imperial power which has seen the barriers to its expansion collapse and is on the move again, taking here, probing there, and pressing relentlessly against the uncommitted, discontented millions of the earth. Capitalizing the zeal to missionize the world of the Russian people, the leaders of the new Russia, armed with force and the old weapon of fomented revolution, use the seductive new weapon of communism to soften their victims. But whatever the trappings, the methods, the weapons, the objective is domination, imperialism. And America, rich, peaceful, and undisciplined, now finds itself face to face with this inscrutable, ruthless conqueror, strong, cunning, and armed with an egalitarian idea that has great appeal for the miserable masses of humanity. No longer is there anyone to protect us. No longer can we sow when and where we are certain to reap. There is no safe investment, no certain harvest any longer. So we've concluded at last that we must rearm and help all our like-minded friends to rearm. We have concluded that the balance of power in the world must once again be redressed. We have concluded that the free world, to continue free, must stand fast against aggression and must hastily confront imperial communism with a preponderance of power. Against that backdrop of danger, a group of sane, responsible men have been assigned the task of diagnosing this national neurosis, the fear of subversive activity within our gates, and to prescribe for an affliction that has been aggravated by the very genuine, indeed the mortal danger from without. The important goal, as most objective observers agree, is to achieve some sanity and balance in an area of our national thinking that is dangerously out of balance.
Thank you, Governor Stevenson. Now, to continue our 20th anniversary roundtable discussion of national security and individual freedom, we hear Francis Biddle, formerly Attorney General of the United States. To present Mr. Biddle, we take you now to Washington.
Do not believe that keeping our country internally secure conflicts with the problem of individual freedom. On the contrary, respect for individual freedom is necessary if we are to sustain internal strength and unity. A regimented America, based on the worship of orthodoxy, is not a strong America. Spies are always a threat, particularly in times like these. We must be eternally vigilant to catch them. But spies are not caught by loyalty oaths and loyalty tests and requirements that communists register. Seth Richardson, the former chairman of the Federal Loyalty Review Board, testified before a Senate committee that the loyal investigations, and I quote his language, had not produced one single case of espionage or turned up any evidence directing towards espionage. Spies are caught by patient, quiet, persistent counter-espionage. This we have in the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The men, chiefly politicians, who say that our public institutions are filled with communists are testifying falsely. Our public institutions are sound. Our public servants overwhelmingly are loyal. The constant attack on their loyalty has created an increasing distrust and disunity in the mind of the public. The obsession increases day by day. Fear of Russia and of war has now become fear of liberalism, fear of change, fear of independent thinking, fear, in fact, of being called communist. It finds expression in the strange procedures of the Un-American Activities Committee of the House and in similar committees of state legislatures. Teachers are investigated. The American Bar Association would have lawyers take test oaths. Jean Muir is dropped, though later reinstated, from her radio spot on unfounded charges. Pearl Buck and Marquis Child are not allowed to speak at a public school in the District of Columbia. Attempts are made to smear Anna Rosenberg. McCarthyism, violent and obscurantist, takes hold. The big lies are reiterated until many believe them. Congress, on the eve of an election, hurries through the ill-considered and inept McCarran law, afraid to resist the spread of thought control. We seem to have forgotten the hysterical years that followed the First World War. The 2000 sedition trials, the infamous Palmer raid, the application of guilt by association to the five socialists who were ousted from the New York Assembly over the passionate protest of Charles Evan Hughes, later Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Now there are but few protests, notably among them President Conant of Harvard, Chancellor Hutchins of the University of Chicago, and those scientists who have seen what all this is doing to the free exchange of scientific knowledge so essential to the growth and to the vitality of our technical equipment. Our freedom has made us great and strong. But Jefferson's philosophy is forgotten, forgotten his own full tide of successful experiments that had kept us free and firm, as he said, kept us the strongest government on earth. We no longer have that faith in ourselves, in our traditions of freedom. Liberty, wrote Walt Whitman, relies upon itself, invites no one, promises nothing, sits in calmness and light, is positive and composed, and knows no discouragement. When the laws of the free are grudgingly permitted, and laws for informers and spies are sweet to the taste of the people, then only shall the instinct of liberty be discharged from that part of the earth.
The program continues from Chicago.
Thank you, Mr. Biddle. You and Governor Stevenson have posed the problem of maintaining our internal security and yet preserving our traditional freedom. To discuss this problem, we now turn to Robert Carr, Executive Secretary of the President's Committee on Civil Rights and Professor of Government at Dartmouth College, and to Harold C. Urey, Nobel Prize-winning atomic scientist and professor of chemistry at the University of Chicago. Mr. Urey, are you worried about our security?
No. I believe the United States of America is a very, very strong position, much stronger than the various people that are discussing this subject would think. I believe that the future belongs to us, not the totalitarian governments. We are celebrating a 20th anniversary. I would like to look forward in discussing this problem to 20 or even 50 years ahead. The future belongs to the democratic free way of life, not to the totalitarian way of life.
Absolutely, Mr. Urey. I hope that throughout all of this discussion of our problem of security, we can remember that as a nation, we are strong and not weak. At the same time, we must be sure that in winning through over this period of 20 years or more, that we do not destroy the very thing we are fighting to save, our free way of life.
I agree. It is very well to look far ahead, as I think we should. But I think it is an excellent idea to remember that you accomplish a long objective only by looking after immediate details. And these immediate details should not be overlooked.
It might be well at the very beginning here to review briefly the present program which is being followed to assure loyalty and security and at the same time to maintain individual freedom. On the part of government, for example, we have the FBI, which is the detective agency, is seeking to enforce our traditional laws against espionage and sabotage. We've developed in the last two or three years an executive loyalty program which seeks to measure the loyalty of our federal employees. We have on our statute book such things as the Smith and McCarran Act. We've had various prosecutions of individuals under these laws. We've had several congressional investigating committees, best known among which, of course, is the House Un-American Activities Committee.
As Mr. Biddle said, Mr. Carr, a moment ago, there have been a great many ways in which investigations of various kinds have also gone into our universities. Assuming that our universities are honeycombed with disloyal persons, something which has never been true in my experience, and, well, I have spent a very large fraction of my life in universities. We've also had the various red channels, these books that are published purporting to give us a list of all the communists in the United States. And listing among them quite prominent people. Does my memory deceive me? I think Mrs. Franklin D. Roosevelt was on one of these.
That's right.
These state-level investigations have also taken place during these last years. Among the most notable of which is the investigation of the University of California by a legislative committee. Or was it by its own board of trustees? We have had the demand for loyalty oaths on the part of universities, state employees, government employees, even county and city employees. All of these various things have been tried.
And now, of course, finally, we have the Nimitz Commission, a group of eminent private citizens set up as a presidential advisory body, and it must consider the basic problem of reconciling our liberty and our authority in the age in which we live. It must, of course, ask itself certain questions. One of the most important questions, which I think it must constantly keep in mind, is this. What is the price that we do have to pay for these efforts, governmental and otherwise, to maintain security and to ensure loyalty? We're paying a price in a good many different ways.
Yes, it's a very high price, from time to time. Might I just mention the price that has been paid and is being paid by certain individuals? Many individuals in the United States have been accused of being disloyal. There has been no satisfactory proof that would stand up in a court of law in most cases leveled against them. They find themselves with damaged reputation. They find the possibility of securing additional other employment or satisfactory employment much more difficult than they expected. Their whole lives are changed as a result of this. Of course, we may say that it is true that young men are being killed in Korea, too, and we shouldn't be too sensitive about a few individuals. However, the boys in Korea are being killed by the enemy. In the United States, the reputations are being destroyed by people who claim to be the most ardent supporters of the American way of life.
Then, too, there is the price we're paying in the area of government. We live in a difficult time. Our government must be strong and vigorous and efficient. We need able personnel in government. And yet it's quite clear that the emphasis that has been put in recent years upon loyalty and security is making it difficult to procure able men for government service. We need in the government service men who have imaginations and curiosity, who are tough-minded. And yet loyalty tends to persuade these employees to play things safe, to think no unusual thoughts, to have no dangerous associations, to read no radical books. The effect, I think, at the level of government personnel can prove to be very serious indeed in these years ahead as we face these serious problems.
And also, along exactly a similar line, the whole effect of this loyalty hysteria, which is what I believe it is to make people in all walks of life play it safe. Think nothing original, nothing new. This is true of our private universities, our state universities. We expect our universities and our colleges to originate new ideas, to train our youth in original thinking and logical thinking. And this, I think, is quite impossible if all the time the professor and the administrative officer has to worry about being accused of being a communist because he expresses an idea which perhaps isn't exactly in agreement with something that someone else in the community thinks. You see, this thing spreads away from communism, away from sabotage, away from being a traitor, into being merely different from what someone else would like to have you be. I think that there has been a very damaging effect upon our universities in the last years because of this hysteria.
And above all, it seems to me we're paying a price in terms of loss of national unity, a sense of strength. We've allowed all of this emphasis upon loyalty to persuade us that we are weak when we are actually strong. We've allowed us persuade us that our government is honeycombed with dangerous, subversive people. We've let one group of the people be stirred up against another group of the people.
We've lost a faith, what you are saying, Carr.
That's right.
We've lost a faith in each other to begin with.
You know, it's been suggested again and again along the way that in the background of all of this loyalty and security program, there may really be a full-fledged communist. That if an international communist had been given the assignment of somehow sowing seeds of dissension and disunity in the United States, that he couldn't very well have thought up anything more diabolically clever than what has been taking place in view of the loss of faith that you mentioned, in view of the dissension and spirit of disunity which has been created.
Every country such as ours that subscribes to the democratic tradition of Western Europe and the United States needs to have a loyal opposition in government and in public. And the opposition should always be regarded as loyal. It isn't that we here plead for a traitorous oath. We plead only that those who disagree with the majority should always have the privilege of disagreeing.
And it is this fundamental right to disagree with the majority that is threatened by this sort of thing. I often think that we are going over to a place where we regard anonymous informers as reliable. A police state doesn't consist of a large number of policemen on the corners. It consists of the police listening to anonymous informers, where every citizen of the country is a potential spy on every other citizen of the community, and the police will punish whoever is accused anonymously. And this sort of thing, to a certain extent, has been practiced in recent years during what I regard as the security hysteria of these recent years.
Oh, we do pay a price. There's no question of that. Now, the Nimitz Commission, it seems to me, must also ask itself the question, to what extent has our security program actually been protecting us?
Well, scientifically, very little, to tell the truth. It's very difficult to tell scientific secrets. It is true that we will have some crooks, some traitors. If you run a large operation, you will have some of these. You should try to avoid them if you possibly can. But I'd like to appeal to our fellow citizens to realize that it is very, very difficult to tell scientific facts. It takes a very intelligent person to understand scientific facts. He must be highly trained. And moreover, scientific things are in their nature very difficult to conceal, on the other hand. If a person is determined to learn some scientific fact, you cannot prevent him from learning it for himself. Thus, the chemistry that takes place in the United States and in the USSR is precisely the same. An intelligent person will get exactly the same answers from nature if he wants to ask them. The geology of this country tells the story of the past history of the Earth. It also tells it from the rocks in Russia. You can't prevent the Russians from learning this, and the Russians can't prevent us from learning it. And the uranium atom behaves just exactly the same on the two sides of the Iron Curtain. And if an intelligent man asks questions of it, it will give precisely the same answers. It is difficult, let me repeat, it is difficult to tell scientific facts to people, but it is almost impossible to prevent people from learning them themselves if they wish to.
It's also clear, Yuri, I think, from the evidence that we've accumulated, that congressional investigations and the executive loyalty program cannot provide us with complete security. One of the things the House Un-American Activities Committee has done, for example, is to build up a file. 1 million names, we're told, of individuals who are regarded as, in some sense, dangerous or potentially dangerous. And yet, a short time ago, when the chemist in Philadelphia, Harry Gold, was arrested and charged with espionage, it was discovered that his name was not in that list of 1 million. Somewhat later, Representative Nixon, a member of the Un-American Activities Committee, complained in the House of Representatives that the existing loyalty program would not have caught Alger Hiss at the time he was a member of the Department of State.
Not only not catch him, but as a matter of fact, no loyalty oath would ever make the traitor loyal anyhow, would it?
That's the point. I can't see that any possible loyalty program we might devise, however efficient it could be, would find the hidden, truly dangerous, subversive espionage agent in the government service. Now, at the same time, I think we've probably got to concede that in this world in which we live, we do need a security program, that we do have a security problem. We just can't get away from it. But I think we've got to keep in mind that there are certain fundamentals of democracy here that must never be forgotten as we go about the business of devising a satisfactory loyalty program. For example, we've got to recognize the ordinary fact that we can never completely eliminate the possibility of risk. Risk exists in the very nature of the case. We can be as certain as anything can be that there are going to be some espionage agents active in the next decade. It seems to me important that we not tear the house down in an attempt to eliminate, finally, all possible risk. That just can't be done.
Yes, we shouldn't burn the house down to get a few rats. It's another way of saying precisely the same thing. We ought to remember that it is important to keep in mind again what we are trying to defend, the American way of life, as we often call it, the right to be accused in public of crimes, to be a right to a fair and open trial, the right to be faced by our accusers, the right to be regarded as innocent until proved guilty, and that unusual and inhuman punishment should not be meted out. These things we must keep in mind while we hunt for a good security program.
Yes, we've got to have that good security program. We've got to have congressional investigating committees, probably. We've got to have loyalty programs. But however much we succeed in perfecting this program, we should also keep in mind that a good loyalty program is necessarily a negative approach to this problem. We also need to move ahead in terms of trying to maintain our national security in a positive way. Our great basic security here, it seems to me, is our democratic faith, our long-standing tradition of democracy. We must try to perfect our democracy, put our best foot forward, to lead from strength and not from weakness. We've come a great way. I would be the last person in the world to minimize the importance of the success we've achieved in democracy. And yet we do have imperfections in our democratic system, and I think we need to concentrate upon perfecting our democracy, and that would be a positive approach which ought to accompany this negative approach.
I agree, and I really think that we should leave the security program in the hands of the regular investigating agencies such as the FBI and the prosecution agencies of the governments and courts. Informers and informants are no good. Laws should be made to punish saboteurs and traitors. In closing, I should like to say that I would like to repeat what I said at the very beginning. I believe that we are leading from strength in this problem. I think the future belongs to us, and that if we will only remember that we are in essentially strong position, we have the correct view of what a government should be. We have the correct regard for the rights of human beings.
Yes,
and if we will only keep to this, our chances of winning out are very strong indeed.
Let's overcome this sense of terror that we seem to have picked up in recent years. We have a problem. I would be the last person to minimize it. But let us remember the great strength of our nation. Let us carry on with our democratic traditions. Let's let the rest of the world see what a strong nation we have, what our way of life is like.
Taking part in today's University of Chicago Roundtable on National Security and Individual Freedom were Governor Adlai Stevenson of Illinois, Francis Biddle, lawyer and formerly Attorney General of the United States, Robert Carr, political scientist of Dartmouth College and Executive Secretary of the President's Committee on Civil Rights, and Harold C. Urey, Nobel Prize winner and atomic scientist of the University of Chicago. Alan Simpson, chairman of the Board of Radio of the University of Chicago, served as host. The printed pamphlet of today's University of Chicago Roundtable program, the anniversary program, contains the full text of the discussion. And in celebration of the 20th anniversary of the Roundtable's first program, February 1st, 1931, a special anniversary pamphlet is also available to you and your friends. This special pamphlet contains excerpts from all the important roundtables in which Chancellor Robert M. Hutchins has participated. You will want copies of this pamphlet, and we'll want to read these statements by Chancellor Hutchins presented during the last 20 years. Individual copies of today's discussion are 10 cents in coin, and copies of the anniversary pamphlet are 5 cents each. Or a copy of the special anniversary pamphlet will be sent to you free with each year's subscription to the Roundtable pamphlet. Send $3 to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, and receive copies of the Roundtable pamphlet for the next 52 weeks. I'll repeat the address, the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Today's program originated from station WRC in Washington and station WMAQ in Chicago and came to you in part by transcription. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.